Watching rom-coms is a spectator sport for me. I cheer when the inevitable happy ending arrives, and I yell when characters make bad choices that will jeopardize their budding romance. Think of me as the equivalent of Bonnie Hunt yelling, "Grace has Bob's dead wife's heart," to Jim Belushi in Return to Me. I know perfectly well what fictional people should do in their love lives, and it's my duty to let them know. The rom-com moments that usually prompt this type of spontaneous outburst from me, I call them hiccups, little obstacles that people are putting in their own way. They frustrate me, in a way that keeps me coming back again and again, because love is so hard on its own. Why make it harder? On the other end of the spectrum, you'll find earthquakes, acts of God that intervene to keep couples apart. An earthquake is more likely to make me have a conversation with the writer. How are you gonna get yourself out of this one? But which type of obstacle works better in a romantic comedy? That's what this episode aims to uncover. It's time for some rom-com decon. All right, welcome to our episode today about hiccups and earthquakes. And my guest is Brandon Treadway, host of the Cinemast podcast. Brandon, say hey.
Hey.
Great. And I invited Brandon to be on the podcast because he is a big movie fan and someone I know who enjoys a romantic comedy, but is not necessarily the level of love that I have for rom-coms.
Which... I don't know many who do come to your level.
So...
No, I do love a few romantic comedies. I love, you know, and we'll get into the ones that I do love. But, like, I've never watched a Hallmark movie.
I mean...
You'll never catch me on a Hallmark episode.
That doesn't surprise me. And any Hallmark references in this episode will be limited. So I am curious to hear what your top three rom-coms are.
Yes. So you told me I couldn't cheat, but I do have a honorable mention that I do. Because I had a big list and I whittled it down. Big list meaning like 8 or 9.
Great.
And I whittled it down. and my honorable mention is He's Just Not That Into You. A movie that I've only seen a couple of times, but I really liked the way that things kind of interwove between the different characters. It was one of the first romantic comedies I think I actually like sat down and watched. And so I think that it gets kind of bonus points from me for that. But
for being one of the first you watched and remembered enjoying.
Yes.
Great. Awesome. I do. That one's not on my like top 10, but I will go back and watch it. Some of those relationships are harder for me to relive than others.
Yeah.
anyway, let's move on.
I will
so we
say,
can get into the meat.
My wife hates Scarlett Johansson for that movie.
My roommate hates Bradley Cooper for that movie. So, hey, maybe that's just the problem one. All right, what's your number two? I mean, number three, because that was your honorable mention.
Yeah, so my number three is The 40-Year-Old Virgin, a movie that I love. It's incredibly charming. It is very crude in a number of spots. I mean, it's basically a movie about Steve Carell losing his virginity. But while I think that the fact that it's a movie where the punchline is, oh, this guy's such a nerd, he's such a dork, he's such a virgin, and the goal of his friends is to help him lose it, I think that he realizes over time that his virginity is actually a strength, something I think we might actually come back to at some point.
We might.
I find... So many of... Well, first off, I mean... So, Rewatchables just did an episode.
Yeah, dropped today as we're recording.
So. I sat down and I was like, oh, look at that. and I started listening to it. And they made the point, they were like, this is... It's such a big, like, jumping on point for a lot of these guys. It's like their first, like, big movie. And it kind of, like, propelled them into, like, this, like, big, like, comedy scene. It was like... You know, Judd Apatow had just done Anchorman like the year before, but now he's doing 40-Year-Old Virgin, and I just love watching Steve Carell be this guy who kind of like discovers who he is and realizes that the thing that he thought was a weakness is actually a strength all along.
Yeah, I feel like the heart, like the way you're describing that to me, sounds like something I would get into. Other than I don't really love crude humor, but we will get back
it's
to
it. It's very crude. I mean, when you have you know, Seth Rogen and Paul Rudd, like, trying to convince him that he should be losing his virginity. Like, they go into some pretty interesting dark places. So
definitely not a Hallmark movie. All right, your number two.
Number two is a movie that I had only first seen previously, and I think I actually talked to you after I watched it, and I was like, I love this movie, and it's Singing in the Rain.
Great.
Which is a romantic comedy, but you know, I think most people just consider it a musical. But gosh dang it, if every single frame of that movie isn't just like dripping with like beauty. I love every minute of it. Even, I mean, I had someone, I was talking to someone, I can't remember who it was, and I was like, oh, I love Singing in the Rain. They're like, even like the end part with just like the two of them dancing and the, and I'm like, especially that part. But yeah, Singing in the Rain, absolutely gorgeous movie. I was smiling from ear to ear literally the entire time I watched it. And yeah, I had to put it at number two.
Excellent choice. Musicals can always be classified lower than musical to some other subgenre. So.
Yeah.
And your number one.
Don't hurt me. So my number one.
This is a safe space.
Okay, so my number one is Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Okay.
A movie that I recommended to you with the caveat of you will probably hate this.
And I did watch it, and I did hate it, but I have now seen it. So.
Yeah, so Scott Pilgrim versus the World, I actually rewatched a little bit of it after I wrote it down as my number one. And it's from Edgar Wright's direction and like Bill Pope's cinematography, like that movie just, while I think it's the movie that I love the most, it can also be considered a romantic comedy rather than saying this is my favorite romantic comedy. So this is kind of a little bit of a cheat.
Eh,
but
it's fine.
That movie has everything that I love. It's funny. It's incredibly well crafted. The screenplay is so like whipcrack smart. It's like it can kind of get you left behind a little bit. And I know that it's probably like a divisive pick for my number one. But please stick around for the rest of this episode. I swear I'll make you
Hey,
proud.
Brandon has good taste. I mean, even if he and I don't appreciate Edgar Wright's aesthetic like I don't and he does, I could watch the movie and go, this is well made. It's just not for me.
Yeah.
So it's definitely worth a watch if you've never seen it. All right. So we're going to play a really quick game. And I stole this game from the Anna Faris' Unqualified podcast. It's called Deal Breakers. And I'm basically going to list some things that if someone did this on a date, would it be like, nah, this is over. This is the end of the
relationship. So I have to say whether or not it's a deal
breaker. Yeah, and I will probably chime in a little bit too. Some of these are inspired by real life, and some of them are inspired by our movie list for
today. Your real life? Are we getting personal here?
In unimportant. what if the person you went out with, you had a really great first date, and then they shook your hand? Is that a deal breaker or like a you're just shy? or we're reading this differently.
Shook my hand. Like put it there, partner?
Sure, even with those words.
I think that's a deal breaker. only because I feel like at minimum, like just a nice like side hug would work better than a hand.
Yeah.
A handshake is like,
our business transaction
exactly.
is over.
Now I'm done and I get to go home.
Great. All right. Let's say someone, the date's going okay. You go back to their apartment and then they show up a collection of unpaid parking tickets displayed on the wall.
I feel like that's from a movie. That's not a deal breaker yet.
All right, cool, interesting. Women, I know, have had a different take on that one, so that's good to know. What if this person quotes half of The Princess Bride uninterrupted after you mention you like the movie? So you're just having a conversation.
That is a deal breaker. Now, we will talk about how much I love that movie, but it is a deal breaker to me when someone doesn't get the hint that they are going on too long.
Yeah, agreed.
It's like, oh, you like that movie? And then they just keep going, like, we get it.
Okay.
We get it.
All right, building off of that, let's say you are interacting with this person, not in a dating scenario, but just in everyday life, and every time you say something to this person, they only respond as you wish.
this is topical.
You can picture that person is also Robin Wright, if that's helpful.
Okay. I would say deal breaker only because I need a little bit more pushback in a relationship, so...
Agreed. I tend to like there to be a good like sense of banter, but like you can tell that it's playful. So if there's just like a total agreement on one side, I'm like, yeah. I'm gonna get bored.
I like a lot of As You Wish, but every once in a while I need a little, no, you don't.
Mm-hmm.
You
know what I mean? Agreed. All right, let's say the person you are on your first date and they then at the end of the night are like, hey, let's go to Bermuda. And they kind of pressure you into it.
That is not a deal breaker at all. I will go to Bermuda, no problem.
Great. Seems like a great, I'd probably say yes to that if I were on like The Bachelor, but everything else I'd probably be like, maybe like third date, Bermuda. I tend to like short first dates though, because I feel like leaving things hanging is a little bit more fun.
I mean, if it's great, like, we can be sensible in Bermuda.
Yeah, it's true.
We don't have to do anything.
It's true.
We can watch TV.
All right. And one final one. This one I think will lead us right into where we're going. What if someone only buys you books with the word death in the title?
So you know I'm a big horror movie fan.
Oh, that's true.
So if they only have death in the title, that means they're probably up my alley a little bit. So I think that's not quite a deal breaker for me.
Okay, great. I like a wide variety of books, and I'm not as much of a horror film fan, so...
In fact, I think I dated a girl who only bought books with the word
death.
Whoa,
you dated the female Alvy Singer?
Yeah, it was a little more gothic than Alvy.
All right, okay, that's all right. All right, so let's dive into what we watched for this episode. First, we chose Annie Hall. I chose, I should say, because the reasons they break up stem from their personalities instead of unstoppable external forces. We also watched That Touch of Mink, which was chosen because it presents not wanting to have sex as a major obstacle, but makes the scenario seem pretty light and humorous. We watched Something Borrowed, which it shows the friendship is a true central relationship and it's tested by one friend cheating with the other's fiance. We watched The Big Sick because the female lead is in a coma for a large portion of the movie. And we watched The Princess Bride because Wesley is thought to be dead at least twice and Buttercup believes she gets married to Humperdinck. So I've got a large range of hiccups and earthquakes on this list.
A lot of problems going on here with these people.
Well, people, there's got to be a conflict for it to be a romantic comedy. All right, Brandon, here's my first question. Do rom-coms generally go too big or too small on the obstacle between the central couple?
So you sent me all these questions before.
I did. You were prepared.
You can see I have this large...
He is very prepared.
So I think... I was thinking about this. So my catalog of romantic comedies I have seen isn't, you know, as vast. But of the ones I have seen, and I was... thinking also kind of in terms of just film in general, when is a conflict too large or too small? And I think that the principle applies across all film. The answer is it feels too big if you need to write your way around it or develop your characters around it. It's too small if your characters don't change from it. And I think that a conflict can feel either too big or too small, depending on your characters as well. So, and I think it all kind of depends on if it feels right or if it feels like it's a conflict that's going to make your characters have to change or face who they are, right? A good example that I thought of, I feel like I'm just branding myself on this podcast with the movies I bring up.
Look, you go to the Cinemass podcast and you'll see his full range. This is just his takes on rom-coms, okay?
So the movie Knocked Up, I think is a good example of using a nice conflict that challenges both characters in different ways, but it's the perfect challenge, right? So Katherine Heigl's character gets pregnant, but she is like, you know, career person, not looking to get pregnant. He is stoner slacker, not wanting to be a dad. But throughout this process of this conflict or obstacle, or this could be considered an earthquake.
The getting pregnant,
yeah.
On like
the,
a second date situation.
They decide that they're going to push through with it.
Yeah.
Both of them, it's kind of this refiner's fire that changes their characters so that they come out better at the end of that movie. Rather than in some cases of a specific movie we're going to be talking about here, where that central conflict is so massive that you just kind of like figure out a way to just like change your characters so that it doesn't apply to them anymore. Because you made it too big. So that's when I think it's too big or too small, is when it doesn't change your characters in the right way.
I agree. I think that character is the key to romantic comedy. And so your obstacle has to pull out just the right traits you want the audience to see in the characters. And I would say the two small examples are anything that happens in a Hallmark movie, which you haven't seen, but I call it on my like Hallmark Christmas bingo board, a misunderstanding that can be solved with a 2-minute conversation.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing that's too small.
That's a really good example.
It happens in, you know, bigger name romantic comedies as well, sometimes to better effect. All right. When do obstacles that are large earthquakes really work or not work? My example is from the things we watched, I think it works in The Big Sick, for example, because she's in a coma and that becomes his time to think about the relationship and really decide what he needs to change in order to be ready for that relationship. And so that's a really big obstacle, but in truth, the obstacle in their relationship was his inability to like really commit to it.
Yeah. He has to like just figure out like who he is too, right? Like, is he going to be 100% in like his like Pakistani family, or is he going to be 100% like in this American culture that he's now a part of, or 100% in this relationship? He needs to kind of figure out those three things. And by removing, his girlfriend's name. His girlfriend.
Emily.
Yeah. So by removing her from the equation, it helps him figure out like what he wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
I've had I was thinking about it as well, and I think when that big obstacle, it kind of back to like the first thing I said, when it helps develop your characters, when it helps develop the setting and the world that they are in, and it moves the story forward. For The Princess Bride, for example, just the idea of the Dread Pirate Roberts and the way that the unseen character of the Dread Pirate Roberts impacts the entire story and the characters is, I think, kind of understated. Just by introducing the Dread Pirate Roberts, you have this villain, quote-unquote villain, that everyone knows in the story, everyone's kind of like afraid of, and no one says, well, who's that guy? Right? They all know who he is. He supposedly kills Wesley, which is like the first conflict, right? That he's supposed to be dead. But then it turns out that Wesley is actually the new Dread Pirate Roberts. He's like, you know, the new guy or whatever. And right. Then now someone else is the...
He put on the mask. He's the Batman now.
That's a good example. And it just adds so much to The Princess Bride. And I think by that, when it doesn't work is when your characters develop, like I said, around it. Perfect example of that is Something Borrowed, which I finished the movie and I remember the next day I was like, what the heck is this movie?
His Slack messages were quite like exasperated.
I was so frustrated. So I was dialed in. Like, I was locked in the movie. I was like, I'm so interested to see what happens. I remember at one point, right before the conversation between Rachel and John Krasinski's character, I paused the movie and I told my wife, I feel like there's 6 different directions this movie can go in, but I'm not sure which one is which yet, because I wasn't feeling like one specific one was developed enough where I could point it out, which at that point I was fine with. I was like, cool, throw me a curveball. Hmm. I was not expecting a curveball like this, where Rachel and Darcy Darcy doesn't know about this cheating thing going on between Rachel and, what's the guy's name? It's something goofy, like Tig.
Tag, I don't know. Take your pick.
So,
sorry, you know, Colin Eggleston.
Between white boy number one. So, like, with that guy, and then later, once that all kind of comes to a head, she finds out that there's cheating going on. Rachel, like, justifies it by going into this kind of revisionist history flashback where she's like, oh, wait a minute. He was in love with me the whole time, and that one night when Darcy put the moves on him, he was trying to put the moves on me, so I'm kind of justified in all of this, right? And then Darcy, like, ends up getting pregnant, and all of a sudden the movie now is trying to tell us that true happiness doesn't come from a relationship, as long as you can get pregnant and bear a child, that's where true happiness comes from. Stay in your lane, Darcy, you child-bearing woman.
I mean, yeah, there's, I really don't know how to interpret that movie either at the end. And
it's like, what are you trying to tell us?
For me, the thing is the obstacle in that movie is too big, and they never make you, they don't lean into the predictability of romantic comedies where you can see, oh, I feel like I should be rooting for Dex, I looked his name up.
There it is.
And Rachel to get together.
That was close with the Tig, right?
It was just like one of those one syllable prep school names.
Yeah.
And they don't really give you any character to root for, and so they all kind of seem awful, and you're just like, why don't you all just go your separate ways and ruin other people's lives, I guess.
Yeah, like the whole, I mean, cheating on your best, cheating with your best friend since you're like, what, 4 years old's fiance is kind of like unforgivable. And then they try and like soften that blow by making Darcy just like kind of a sucky person. But like you said, no one's really likable because everyone's doing terrible stuff the entire movie. And so when everyone's like, quote unquote, happy at the end, you're like, great. Every one of you suck except for John Krasinski, who's still alone in England.
Playing Jim, but in a movie this time where Roy wins, basically. That's
exactly what happens.
All right, let's talk about hiccups now. When do small obstacles really work or not work?
These work the best. I think these work the best in general because hiccups are the most relatable to us. And so it's easier for us to see ourselves in these movies, and they make them just that more fun to watch. The perfect example is kind of Annie Hall, where it's just a thousand little hiccups because that's just how relationships go, especially when you don't end up with that person at the end of your story. That person is just hiccup after hiccup after hiccup, and sometimes you are able to get past those, and sometimes it's just so many hiccups that you're like, I can't keep going anymore.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I hadn't thought about it from that perspective, but as someone who's single, I always feel like in the early phases of, is this going to be a relationship, even a hiccup feels like an earthquake. It's like, oh no, should I have not sent that text? Like, did he read that weird? So yeah, it feels relatable because even if it's small, it's like your emotions are going really fast at the beginning and kind of when things are coming to a head in a relationship.
Yeah, that's, I mean, so I wrote some examples down here. So Annie Hall, yes. The 40-year-old virgin, the hiccup there is just, because I also said that the best hookups aren't the ones that we can relate to, but they're the ones that come from character traits. That like, you are this person, and that's why it's a hiccup. It's not like earthquakes feel more like the external forces working their way in. 40-year-old virgin, his virginity is kind of like the hiccup because he is scared to get closer to the woman he's dating for fear that she might find out that he's a virgin and judge him for it, and that leads to stuff. Friends, we were on a break is kind of like a recurring hiccup in the relationship. That again, I think plays to what you said. It's a hiccup that turns into an earthquake, and that's just kind of all Ross and Rachel really is
right. Hiccups are they actually compatible? The world will never know.
I mean, how easily could, so the pros cons list, right? How easily could you have explained that? Yet that becomes an earthquake that like shatters their like first real shot. Anyway, we'll find out in the Friends reunion on HBO Max. But then careers in life, just moving people apart. La La Land's a great example. I know some people, your mileage may vary on the end of La La Land. I've told you that is the reason I love that movie is because of the end. And that just feels so real to me when I see the way that something as simple as a career choice or different priorities can pull people apart, because that's just so real in real life.
Great. I would add one final thing in that romantic comedies often make the small obstacle another person. So the beginning of the movie, so-and-so is dating someone else, and the way they do that incorrectly is they'll make that person just seem like, why are you even dating this person in the first place?
Yeah.
again, a frequent thing that happens in Hallmark movies. I usually say it's the boyfriend with Wall Street hair who's just like way too into his career, obviously.
I've never seen one. I know exactly who you're talking about.
Of course you do.
His name's Chad.
Exactly. It's a one-syllable name. Anyway, but I have seen it done well. I would say Walter in Sleepless in Seattle. Have you seen that
yes.
at all? So
the
Bill Pullman character in Sleepless in Seattle, he's a really nice guy. You can see why she's with him, but you can also see what she's missing in that relationship and why she chooses to leave. I personally, like, 90s Bill Pullman is, like, peak dude for me, so...
Yeah, on your first episode, you gushed about him a little bit.
Yeah. Which,
yeah, and he's so great in that one, too, because, yeah, he's a hiccup, but also he kind of becomes, like, a door, right? Because doesn't he say, like, look...
He releases her.
I get it, all right?
Yeah.
It's Tom Hanks.
Yeah, he's like, marriage is too hard to go into with such low expectations,
yeah.
And, you know, so... You come away going, man, I hope he finds a person. You don't hate him, and you appreciate his presence in the movie.
Yes,
so.
Yes.
All right, let's go really quickly. Cringeworthy messages you got from the movies on our list today.
Briefly, again, the idea that, from Something Borrowed, the idea that a woman should just be okay with being cheated on by her best friend because a woman's true happiness only comes from her ability to have children. Big yikes on that one.
Yeah, definitely feels less of 2011 and more of 1941.
Yeah, like that feels like that feels like a Cary Grant movie. And then the power dynamics and sexual politics in That Touch of Mink are a little like kind of out of wits at that. But I think the time period is so different there. Like looking at it now, what's 50, 60 years later,
right.
Like. It's a lot easier to look back and say, wow, things were really bad back then when it came to this kind of stuff.
Yeah, we have our lens on of how we watch and create films today, which has still got problems, obviously, but is not got a gay panic joke running through it.
Yeah.
And it's not basically like men want to have sex before marriage, women shouldn't.
Yeah.
That says who you are as a person. It's basically, I wrote that it's of its time for better and for worse.
Yeah. I've got a question for you. So I was watching That Touch of Mink yesterday, and I was thinking to myself, there needs to be a name for this. And this is something I think that you should add to your repertoire of things. You got to come up with a name for this. And what would it be like if That Touch of Mink, you take Cary Grant's character out, and you put in like a Chris Farley, like a fat, slobby guy, how does our view or our lens of that character shift? All the same lines, all the same stuff, all the same locations, same characters. Just, I think that a film like that changes.
Like a Shallow Hallie situation?
Yeah, where like we view that kind of sexual advancement and that kind of those kinds of sexual politics or power dynamics differently when we go, whew, Cary Grant is hot.
Right.
Then we
it's
do.
How The Bachelor or The Bachelorette works.
It's so true, right? And so I wonder, like, I was kind of thinking, like, does a film hold up better if you replace the character with someone that's less, you know, quote unquote, attractive or more appealing? I wonder if those kinds of hiccups and earthquakes hold up better because it's more about the character's personality and heart than it is about their looks. Like, would Kathy have been as excited to fly to Bermuda with Brendan Gleeson? Or would she be like...
Maybe Donald Gleeson.
So, anyway, that was just something I thought of. I think that we give Philip Shane a pass on some of the stuff that he says simply because he's Cary Grant. And if it had been someone else, we'd be like, yikes.
Well, even her friend in that movie, though, is kind of the surrogate for that point of view. Of
Love
like,
Connie. Best character
yeah,
in the movie.
Yeah, you go up to the place and you see Cary Grant, and all of a sudden you're not mad that he ruined your coat and splashed you with water and made you late for your job interview. You're like, let's spend the day together. Let's go sit in the Yankees, I just forgot the term for it, that place
dugout.
For the biggest.
Yeah.
I, of the two of us, like baseball more than Brandon, so that's embarrassing that he just had to remind me of the word
that's
dugout.
Funny. Also, great cameos from the...
Right? I mean, so there's some real charms in that movie. I mean, he buys her a whole new wardrobe in order to go to Bermuda.
Every movie should have a fashion show sequence.
Yes. I wrote the wardrobe parade scene.
Yes. Every movie needs to have one of those.
It's a great
element. I'm pretty sure 40-year-old Virgin has one too, now that I think of it.
It's a good time. All right. I was going to say valuable lessons, but let's save that for our dive into the individual movies.
Okay.
How would you rank these movies on a scale from hiccup to earthquake, ridiculous to insurmountable?
Okay. So I was confused on this question, so I wanted to clarify. Are we talking, oh, this is like something I could get over to, like, I could never forgive this?
Just which obstacle seems the most hiccupy and which obstacle seems the most earthquakey.
Okay, so I think Annie Hall's probably the most hiccupy because it's just who these characters are. And eventually someone will line up with Alvy's neuroses. So that's the first one. I think that Touch of Mink is probably number two if I'm going from hiccup to earthquake. Mm-hmm. That Touch of Mink, I mean, they're eventually able to overcome this. And I think that, again, had they had a 2-minute conversation, we probably would have saved ourselves a lot of trouble.
Right. Not as many rashes in Bermuda.
Yes. Third one, let's see. I want to say the Big Sick because, this is going to sound insensitive, people get sick and relationships survive illness. And theirs clearly did. I mean, they are married to this day. But it's definitely, it was definitely quite the earthquakey hiccup for her to go into a coma. I think the fourth one for me is probably, this one's tough. Because Wesley doesn't do anything wrong. He just gets killed twice. But he's also not really dead. And then he's mostly dead. So I'm going to go Princess Bride at number four, and then the unforgivable sin of sleeping with my fiance, I think, is something borrowed, and I don't know if I could stay friends with someone who slept with my fiance before.
I mean, that's repeatedly. Fair. Right. Absolutely. All right. So I ranked it pretty similar to you, Annie Hall, That Touch of Mink. I put something borrowed in the middle.
You could get over that?
I'm not saying I could get over it. I'm saying I think I ranked it there because it just seemed like the movie didn't solve the problem either. So
just have to walk your separate ways?
Yeah, it just... And I'll tell you what. I put The Big Sick and then my most earthquakey was The Princess Bride. And I think it's because I just made a list of like all of the things that are stopping their relationship and they just seem huge, huge, huge. So... we're going to get into that, but let's dive into Annie Hall, first of all. So, I know you really like this movie, Brandon.
I do.
I watched it last night,
I wrote it here on my favorites. You can see, I scratched out Annie Hall at number two, because I knew we were going to talk about it, and I didn't want to give it...
So, it's like his 2.5, yeah. Essentially. Great. I have to be honest, I do not love Annie Hall, which seems like some kind of sacrilege in terms of romantic comedies. I know it's like... in the Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. I think for me, it just feels like a bad date that just keeps going on. And you're like, I'm kind of into this person, but also I'm kind of not into this person.
So do you
know what I mean?
Because it's mostly just like cringy?
There's definitely cringy.
It's cringy. That's why I like it maybe. At least partially. I like
it's
watching
cringy,
it. It's cringy.
And obviously the politics and the circumstances of Woody Allen are difficult and kind of color everything.
There's a quote towards the end of the movie. I think it's in like the
about
last,
the
twins that are 16, yes. Where I was like, yikes, this yeah. Doesn't work.
So
didn't work then, definitely doesn't work
right.
Now.
So there's a lot of good articles out there that you can find about critiquing Annie Hall 40 plus years after it has come out and mm-hmm. kind of how the world colors it. I don't want to get into that much too here. I want to focus on the substance of the movie. What's the main obstacle? So just that his personality, her personality to an extent?
Yeah, so I said main conflict here is specifically, I think, Woody Allen's neuroses,
yeah.
Or Alvy's neuroses in this movie, that he just overthinks every single tiny little thing, and he's always worried about all these different things. And more broadly, both their personalities, while I think that they work kind of in the early stages of dating, I mean... As you get deeper and deeper into a relationship, like, your personalities need to match up far more, or at least click better. I mean, there are personality traits my wife has that I have that don't necessarily, like, click super great, but you need to make concessions down the road about what you care about. And I think the two of them have two totally different ideas of what they want out of themselves and from each other. And I think, yeah, I think it just comes down to personality. And it's a good example of people who love each other very much don't always necessarily need to end up together.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not in the same La La Land vein where just the circumstances of their careers are pulling them apart. This is more the circumstances of I don't want to shift this. I don't want to shift that. Do you feel like they over or underplay this obstacle?
So this one I think is unique in that it overplays it, but it fits because Alvy overplays everything.
Right.
And so for him to, I mean, because when it really kind of, I mean, it doesn't boil down to this, but like the breaking point was LA versus New York for, and which is kind of indicative of their relationships, right? She's more of an LA type girl that she realizes when she gets out there. He's very much the cynical New York person, which is symbolic of their conflict. And, but I think that all the, that conflict together is overplayed because we need to overplay it because we're also seeing this through the lens of Alvy. He's telling us this story from the very beginning. He breaks the fourth wall. He is the narrator of this story. So I think it's perfect the way it is.
Yeah, it does feel just right. And I've saw some critics wondering, do we even trust Alvy as a narrator? Is he reliable or is he tweaking things to for his point of view? I mean, he does at the end.
Yeah, I definitely think he does.
Yeah, so it's sort of, this is how you remember a relationship. You remember what you remember about it, the way you remember it, and the other person probably remembers it differently.
Yeah.
Great, which is why it's a good match with 500 Days of Summer, which I don't think Brandon has watched yet, but we are going to be talking about that on his podcast.
Yes, check out the Cinemass podcast. Whitney's coming on. We're going to talk 500 That's Days right. of Summer, a movie that I've purposely avoided watching since it came out.
So, yeah, you'll like it way more than Something Borrowed, I can guarantee that. any key moments in the movie? I want to start on this one, actually. I love the lobster scene when they're just trying to boil some lobsters and they're kind of chasing them around the kitchen. And it just seems like a quirky little fun moment that would be a good memory of a relationship no matter where it goes. And I love that he tries to recreate it with someone else.
Yes, I got goosebumps thinking about it because I love that part.
And I just love that, that example, without analyzing it in words, shows you that you can have the same experience with two people, but the personalities of the people involved and like the level of affection for that person totally colors whether that romantic scenario works.
Yeah. So the question is like, how does it contribute to like the perception of the obstacle?
Right.
I'm hoping that I thought about this the right way.
No wrong answers.
But I think that the opening scene, the opening monologue, and then kind of the closing monologue kind of help color the rest of the movie a certain way, at least for me, where we start out with Alvy telling us that they broke up. Like that he's telling us a breakup story, right? And at the end of the movie, where I think a lot of breakup stories are kind of like, you know, Midsummer, for example, I burned my boyfriend alive in a ritual ceremony. And a lot of breakup movies end, you know, there's the catharsis of we are broken up and now I'm moving on to something better. This one, there is the catharsis of we broke up, but we still love each other. We still care about each other. He talks about how they meet back up. And they ran into each other in New York and they went to lunch and they just talked about all the great times they had. There's something very satisfying about feeling that with someone. You know, I have had girlfriends in the past that I've run into, you know, or gone to lunch with after the fact that we dated, and, you know, just being able to kind of talk through the relationship and laugh about the things that were great and skip over the things that weren't so great and just enjoy kind of what we enjoyed about each other at the very beginning when we were, you know, quote unquote, just friends. Is great. And so something I think colors their relationship and is symbolic of or not necessarily symbolic, but highlights the obstacle before we even really see it is or I guess he's, I can't remember if he says it at the beginning or the end, but he says, I would never want to belong to a club that would have me as a member.
Yeah, that's part of the opening monologue. Yeah.
The Groucho Marx quote.
And then he repeats it later after, I think he's having sex with one of his wives. He's like, oh, right, this is why this never works for me.
Yeah. And so I think that's kind of indicative of, like, this is the conflict we're going to see, is that he doesn't feel comfortable in relationships because he is in the relationship, so it can't be that good.
Right.
So.
Which is maybe why he writes a story about, you know, writes a play about he and Annie's relationship, changes the ending, because when you're looking at it from that perspective, you're not really part of it. It's just a version of you.
Yes.
Great. And I want to talk about the resolution. Are you happy or unhappy with the resolution of the story?
So this one, I said it's not fair to feel either way, because it's just, it feels like a real ending. And, you know, he tries to get her back. He flies out to LA. That doesn't work. So he ends up writing that play kind of as this, like, cathartic outlet for expressing his feelings and emotions about that relationship. And they do end up seeing each other again, like we said, and they're able to look back on their time together. And I think that seeing them go their separate ways and they're both happy, I think that's a good resolution. Are they together? No. But I loved the quote he says at the very end, relationships are totally irrational and absurd, but most of us keep going because we need the eggs. Where he tells a story about, like, the egg
joke. I do, and like that part too.
There is, you know, there is a need for those relationships. Even this person who's so cynical about them knows that these are necessary because there's something you get from another person that you cannot get from yourself. And so even though he's not getting that from Annie anymore, he knows going forward that that is necessary. So I think everyone's happy at the end, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like he's happy as he can be. You know, he seems like someone who's always analyzing his level of happiness, which decreases your level of happiness. But I also just love they play her singing Seems Like Old Times. It's a little montage of, like, the best parts of their relationship.
Get more lobsters.
Yeah, and that's the end. And I think that's sometimes, it's a perfect encapsulation of what the end of a relationship can feel like. Of just like, all right, I'm going to put these good memories in a place, and this is what they sound and feel like to me.
Yeah.
All right. That Touch of Mink. We've talked a little bit about this. What is our main obstacle here?
The main obstacle here is Philip Shane wants to have sex with Doris Day. She does not. She's trying to, like, save herself from marriage. And just, like, miscommunication between the two that she is interested in him and wants to date him. She likes the way that he kind of, like, provides for her, which, well, that's something problematic we didn't really talk about.
There's time. The movie is called That Touch of Mink. I mean.
But anyway, he feels like the fact that they haven't done it yet means that she's not interested. And so they, like, try and play up that comedy a little bit. And she kind of, what I thought was interesting is that he kind of becomes disapproving later, that he thinks that she's going to sleep with, like, Beasley. And so it, like, flips all of a sudden. He's like, oh, that's what, you know, like, he doesn't say that, but, like, he starts to think about her in a way that is so, like, prude-like, where, like, bro, you, like, this is what you've been doing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's got some really complicated sexual politics going on. And I think for me, I loved this movie growing up, I think because of the wardrobe parade. And Doris Day just always has the best clothes. And I mean, who doesn't want to watch a Doris Day movie with Cary Grant in it? But you take out those, like, superficial things that make this movie fun and attractive. And thinking about it as an adult woman, I was like, wow, this woman, she has this sense of, like, society says a woman shouldn't have sex before she gets married, but she doesn't really seem to think about it beyond that. Like, she doesn't say, this is why I don't have sex before I get married, or this is why I would. You know, she doesn't have any sense of why that value is how she's lived her life.
Yeah, it's just, you know, a woman's place back then. And for her, she's totally fine with that.
Right.
And for Cary Grant's character, a man's place is to, you know, at that time is to seduce the woman out of that place that society tells him he's supposed to be in.
She refuses to have sex with him. She goes to Bermuda, making it seem like she's going to, and then she refuses, and then she flies there again. And then, in order to resolve the conflict, she basically does the same thing to him with someone else, sort of like uses the guy from the employment agency. And like you said, that sort of flips Cary Grant, Philip Shane's mind, and he's like, oh wait, I do want a committed relationship here. Yeah. And it doesn't seem like anyone really changed, except that she got a new wardrobe and he decided he could be married to her. Whether or not he's faithful is not a question the movie addresses, but...
Yeah, which kind of skips to the question of, are you happy or unhappy with the resolution? Eh, I said unhappy. You just kind of jump to married.
Right, you know? Like 9 to 10 months later, there's a baby and they're married and apparently...
he's got chicken pox or whatever.
Right, like on their wedding night, he's the one who gets the rash. Like, as if sex is just something that... you know, makes you uncomfortable depending on what type of relationship you're in when you do it. So yeah,
I will say, shout out to Philip Shane for not sleeping with her when she was drunk. As soon as that happened and he walked in, I was like, oh no, oh no. The way this movie's been going, I feel like we're going to get a little, we're going to start going in a direction I don't want to see. But it ended up, you know. So hijinks ensue, so that helped.
He does seem to understand and respect consent.
Yes, which is good.
So,
did you know that Cary Grant like hates this movie?
I did come across that. I am not sure.
I think
he just thought it was kind of maybe fluffy. I don't know. He's made other movies similar to this, but
I wonder if he. Yeah, maybe he thought this movie was just like, I don't know.
I don't want to speak for him. I don't know why he doesn't like this
movie.
I
was Googling, and I was like, why does he hate this movie?
But he wasn't a fan. So if you're not a fan either, hey, that's okay. All right, Something Borrowed. We've talked a lot about this. The main obstacle being that Rachel, the Jennifer Goodwin character, is secretly in love with Dex, the fiancé of
Darcy,
the Kate Hudson character. And then she and Dex start sleeping together and hiding it from Darcy.
Is Kate Hudson in the Romantic Comedy Hall of Fame?
Who's
your Rushmore?
For the 2000s, she is. I would say my Rushmore, I'm going to put Cary Grant and Doris Day up there. Not necessarily for that touch of mink, but more for
her stuff,
and he's got some pretty good stuff. More recent times, I would have to say Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks with, like, honorable mention Sandra Bullock.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she's in some good ones and some really bad ones, but Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan together is gold. So.
Okay, nice. Don't ask me that question.
I was like, yeah, I don't want to force you. Anyway, but Kate Hudson is definitely sort of like the it girl of early 2000s romantic comedies.
Yeah. How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. Made the short list. Probably was going to be maybe number 5.
Yeah. It's a good one. Yeah. And she and Matthew McConaughey definitely have some chemistry, so which is why they've been paired together. Fool's Gold. An interesting film. I mean...
You know, the Philippines does that. I know we're getting a little off topic here. Yeah, this is how my podcast goes. But the Philippines does that where they will, like, pair people together, and they'll just be in every movie together. And they're like... y'all got chemistry, and a lot of times they end up dating in real life.
I mean,
like,
sure.
You guys are in every show, every movie together. Make it happen.
It's not the worst idea. great. So we both feel like the movie just doesn't know what to do with this obstacle.
Yeah, it underplays it. I hate it. I was so mad at the end of the movie. And like I said, I was feeling it. I was like, up until that John Krasinski scene, I was like, you guys can take this any direction. Surprise me. I did not like the surprise that I got.
You didn't like that just sitting there. Honestly, this movie kind of reminds me of like The Great Gatsby, where the John Krasinski character, is like the narrator. Mm-hmm. He's like sitting outside of it. And then there's like three pretty horrible people who are like sort of in this weird love triangle. And like it's going to be a death at the end. So a death of a friendship.
I wish there had been a death at the end of that movie.
Key moments. I think for me, the key moment is really just that they do that Salt and Peppa dance, which shows you how deep their friendship was. And then, is that the right? Push It. Is that by Salt and Peppa? Yeah. Okay, great. I was like, maybe I'm too white right now.
Good job.
But to me, that's like, that's the only scene that really carries any weight showing the depth of anybody's relationships.
I think that whole opening scene, that opening party is really good because it shows you how close they are, but also shows you the distance between them, right? The fact that she would think that Rachel wanted that party when really it was all about Darcy.
Yeah.
Right? An opportunity for her to get on the stage and do her, like, sing, you know, song and dance thing toward Dex is like, okay, time to go.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that, that's a perfect little opening for that movie because it does show you the closeness but also the gaps in their relationship where little Dex can come on in.
Right. And let's just talk about Dex for one more minute. I honestly, I don't know if I'm just trying to not blame the women, but I feel like he's pretty culpable in this.
Yes, absolutely.
He initiates the kiss in the taxi. He's the one who lets Rachel say, hey, ask out my friend, and doesn't say, hey, no, I'm actually into you. And then just lets it go for however long.
Yeah, and also he pursues the line of thinking when Rachel's like, oh, you were never into me or something like that. He is the one that's like, oh, no, I totally was. Back in law school. So, yeah, Dex sucks. Dex sucks.
More recently seen on the Hallmark Channel. Anyway, all right, let's move on from Something Borrowed. I don't really have anything else to say about it. And we haven't really touched that much on the Big Six. So the main obstacle here. The obvious one being that the Emily character is in a coma for the middle of the movie, but I honestly feel like the true obstacle of this movie is sort of she's constantly saying, I'm not really dating right now, and he's constantly saying, not telling her that his mom's trying to get him into an arranged marriage. And so that finally comes to a head in that moment when she finds the box of photos and yells 5 months of red flags to herself. Like, that really hits home for me because Brandon's almost crying. Not because I've had 5 months of red flags, but because dating sometimes feels like you're trying to walk this line between, do I justify this or do I, like, is it a deal breaker for me?
I think culture is itself is kind of a major obstacle here. You know, obviously we talked about it earlier, the disease, the coma, yes, that's an obstacle, but the real one at the heart of that relationship is a difference in culture. Like, he is worried about being with her because it can impact his family. I also wrote down there's multiple relationships with culture at the center, right? His relationship with his family is strained because of culture. His relationship with, is it Emily? It's Emily, right?
Emily is her name in real life, so I assume that's what they call her in
Emily,
the movie.
Yeah, Emily, because I can't remember, but that relationship is strained because of culture, and
even his relationship with the Ray Romano character, because Ray Romano is sort of like that white dad who says things, not really hearing how they come out. Like, I want to talk to someone like you about 9/11.
Which is my favorite line, I think, in the entire movie.
Really,
it's so good.
Funny and totally drawn from character, which is what makes it so good.
Yes. but let's see. Yeah, I think I've dated someone outside of my culture. I've dated multiple people outside of my culture, and I got really deep into a relationship with someone where I was like, there was the feeling of this isn't gonna, or we're just so culturally different that this isn't going to end up working out at the end, and we really pushed really hard to make it work. We both made concessions for the other in order to like try and maybe like work to the point where culture is a smaller problem. But man, things like that are just so like deeply ingrained in who we are. Like, that just like makes you who you are in so many cases that, breaking out of it, it can be really difficult. And, you know, for him, he's totally trying to do that, but he's trying to have the best of both worlds, which I think is possible, where he could say like, look, I love my family. We're a little bit different. I'm not looking for an arranged marriage. You know, I want to actually marry someone that I actually love rather than, you know, the wonderful relationship I'm seeing across from me at the table where you guys just kind of live together. And then, you know, with her, she's like, he's trying to keep things from her because I think in his mind, he's not seeing these proposed marriages as anything more than, you know, swiping on Tinder that his mom's doing for him.
Right.
But for her, she's like, what is this box of Polaroids of random Pakistani women? And so, yeah. And for her, the red flags is like all those red flags of them not necessarily clicking because they're just from two different worlds and they're trying to figure out a way to like make them work.
I think this movie also really works on other levels that other rom-coms often fail in. It has some really great side characters. There's comedy that's, again, derived from those characters. It's not just like a lot of slapsticky situations, which I think becomes a crutch in a lot of romantic comedies. It's much more about what they say and the tone in which they say it and how it moves the plot along.
Yeah, and a lot of times those characters are idiots, and that's where you get a lot of your comedy from, is like, oh, this dumb friend. But in this one, everyone feels like a fully realized character. And even though side characters have side plots, I mean, her parents have that little thing where, like, he cheated on her, and there's all this kind of, like, strife there going on where this obstacle is actually kind of bringing them together in a situation where that would probably have happened normally. I know you're going to ask about the overplay-underplay thing, which sure. Actually kind of leads me, like, leads me into this, which is I think that this gets it just right. Because it actually doesn't adhere to the typical like earthquake as a like coming together trope. Like when I was a kid, we're gonna get personal here. So when I was a kid and I really liked a girl, this is gonna sound so funny or weird or lame, but when I really liked a girl, I was like, man, imagine she got kidnapped and I got to go on and I like found the kidnappers. And like went on this like crazy adventure and like saved her, and that's how she fell in love with me, because the earthquake is used by Hollywood all the time to bring characters together. Look at Romancing the Stone, like perfect example, right?
Great.
Like she gets kidnapped and he goes and ends up saving her, and then they fall in love and then they get a boat. So
and then they make a terrible sequel.
But so I always wanted that, and I think, well, when I'm young, we're talking like 12 years old here. I wasn't 22, like, man, someone kidnapped this chick for me. But I think The Big Sick does a good job of, you know, once she comes out of that coma, she's still like, hey, I know you made a lot of progress, but I was in a coma, so I did not make any progress. So, like, we're going to have to, like, start from scratch here. Where I think in some cases they would be like, and then they came together right away. You were here the whole time? So I love that, the way that kind of, you know, I guess that's also the resolution.
But. Yeah, I mean, leading into the resolution, I think it's a really good resolution because a couple of unexpected things happen. She wakes up, he moves to New York City. Like, they're not in the same city anymore. And then she shows up and you don't really fully see their reconciliation, but you know it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And then they show the fun pictures of them actually being married.
Well. Yeah.
All right. And finally, last but not least, The Princess Bride. I'm going to really quickly read the list of obstacles here. Wesley's going to go to America. Wesley supposedly dies by the Dread Pirate Roberts. She is engaged to a prince. She gets kidnapped by Vizzini and his henchmen. They get lost in the fire swamp with R.O.U.S.'s lightning sand and fires. They are separated again when they get out of the fire swamp. Then Wesley dies by the machine. He's unable to move because he's been brought back to life by a miracle pill. And then she goes through a wedding ceremony and is pretty sure she got married to Prince Humperdinck. That's some pretty big obstacles. Like, I feel like a rom-com usually approaches like maybe two of those, and yeah. We've got like eight or nine.
this goes to show for me how perfect The Princess Bride is, that it's able to balance all these obstacles. And if you look at the list that you have here, each obstacle leads pretty much to the next obstacle. Like, He goes to America, which results in him dying, which results in her getting engaged, which results in her getting kidnapped, which results in her getting, you know what I mean? So like everything leads to the next thing. I watched this and then I came and talked to you. I was like, okay, The Princess Bride is the best. It's like a perfect movie. It's so good. Yeah, the obstacles are numerous, but freaking Wesley can't stop dying. Just stay alive for 5 minutes and we'll be okay, man.
I want to say that I think this really works because they're not doing the typical rom-com thing of they have a scene together and then they go and talk to their friends about it and like act like they're in junior high and then they come back together and then they're like, oh, what did he mean by this? Like, there's none of that in this movie. It's like they're in love and obstacles are happening. Like, there is none of this. I don't know if I want to be with him or am I going to be able to say I love you?
Yeah, they don't need to find their way to each other as far as love is concerned.
Right.
They love each other from the very beginning and everything is just keeping them from being together until the very end.
It's delightful. Great casting, like maybe perfect casting other than the lack of diversity in the cast, which is, again, more of like a 2020 lens than a 1987 lens.
Yeah. Also, I think, yeah.
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 We don't need to dive too much into that. Let's see. And I love that Goldman's script just really plays with audience expectations.
Yeah.
You have the Peter Falk and Fred Savage reading the book together, and then pretty quickly, like, as soon as she goes up on that horse ride and gets kidnapped, you're not with Peter Falk and Fred Savage until she and Wesley are reunited and you know it's him.
Yeah, and it's fun to... I remember the first time... When I first saw this movie, I think I was 9 years old. And my mom had rented it from Blockbuster and she watched it. And I was like, oh my gosh, I do not want to watch this. And I didn't. And it's so funny because I was the Fred Savage character. So then, like, you know, before we had to return it, my mom was like, can you sit down for 20 minutes? It, like, dead on, like, Peter Falk, like, can I stop reading you the story, you know? And we started watching it, and I fell in love with it.
Of course you did. All right, I want to make one last quote from The Princess Bride, which I think is a key moment of the movie, right before we go back to Fred Savage saying, is this a kissing book? This is when Wesley says, death cannot stop true love. All I can do is delay it for a while. So that seems like a good central message of the movie that they really do overcome a lot.
And honestly, kind of an encapsulation of everything we've talked about.
Yeah.
These obstacles can't stop love. They can only delay it. Unless in the case of something borrowed, in which case that movie can just burn in a fire.
Is that really true love? I don't think so. All right, Brandon.
He'll cheat on her too.
Give a quick 30-second pitch for the Cinemask podcast for my listeners.
Oh yeah, Cinemask podcast. So every week we pretty much talk about one movie, and we've talked from everything from, you know, Batman versus Superman to we just did Pride and Prejudice. We have episodes where we talk about movies we love. We talk about movies that we don't love. We have ranking episodes. I mean, our next episode is going to be Christopher Nolan movies ranked in preparation for Tenet. And then you and I are talking 500 Days of Summer. And it's just a fun show where we just talk about movies and why we like these movies that we like and why we hate these movies we hate. So, yeah, check us out. We're everywhere you can find podcasts. Feel free to check us out and subscribe.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for being here, Brandon.
You bet. Thank you.
That sound cue means it's time for the flavor of the week. I was inspired by Brandon's question about my Mount Rushmore romantic comedies, and surprisingly, I don't think I would change any of the actors I put up there under the time pressure of recording. Cary Grant plays some of the best roles in rom-coms from the 30s and 40s, opposite equally imposing names like Rosalind Russell and Katharine Hepburn. Plus, most of his final films qualify as rom-coms to some degree, including his last, Walk Don't Run, a personal favorite. Aside from my mother, no woman is more responsible for my love of rom-coms than Doris Day. My mom introduced me to her, and I spent my growing up years idolizing her wardrobe and her careers in the trio of movies she made with Rock Hudson. Her final film is also a rom-com I love, with Six You Get Egg Roll. It's hard to find, but check your local library. And then, of course, Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan. They wouldn't be up there without the unique talents of Nora Ephron, writer and director extraordinaire who knew just how to play them off of each other. Tom's earliest successes, Splash and Big, were rom-coms, and he even wrote and directed one himself. My all-time favorite movie of any kind, That Thing You Do. Meg, of course, steals the show in When Harry Met Sally, but you should also be sure to catch her in IQ. She's got a wardrobe even Doris would be jealous of. That's it for this week's episode of RomCom Decon. To get in touch with me, reach out to @RomComPod on Twitter or RomComPod@gmail.com.